slouch hat upon my head, a worn-out blanket for my bed, and I'll go riding down that Texas trail.
Have you ever thought about the origins of the cowboy hat? One of the enduring symbols of the American West, today its popularity as headwear lives on in many parts of the country. Though the urban cowboy craze of a few years ago in Philadelphia, at least, never seemed to have really taken hold. But then fashions are notoriously and sometimes devastatingly capricious. In any case, one would suppose that the design of the cowboy hat evolved over the years in the mines and ranches of the Old West. In fact, however, it was the brainchild of a young hatter from Newark, New Jersey, who had gone west to cure a tubercular condition. Upon returning east, he settled in Philadelphia, where he began a business that eventually became the largest and most famous manufacturer of men's hats in the world. For many generations, the Stetson Hat Company was a fixture in the Kensington section of Philadelphia.
Radio programs on the history of Philadelphia through the memories of those who have lived, loved, and labored in this, the fairest city in the land. Come back with us now to the days when businesses were run like a family, salaries were paid in gold coins, and all men wore hats, as we take you to one of the city's largest and most prestigious manufacturing complexes in a program entitled, You Work at Stetson's? Oh, you got a good job.
If you drive north on 4th Street above Girard Avenue, you'll get to a large, somewhat triangular, gravel-strewn lot as you intersect Montgomery. If you look real hard, at the peak of the largest building on the far side, you should be able to make out the name The Stetson Hospital. This is all that remains of the Stetson Hat Company, a huge complex of buildings which once boasted over 26 acres of floor space, and which during its heyday employed over 5,000 workers. Every operation in the manufacture of a hat, from skinning of the furs to making of the boxes in which the finished toppers were packed, was performed on this one site. And Stetson's was the top of the line. There was no better hat to be found anywhere in the country. Presidents, Hollywood stars, men of wealth and position, they all came here to be fitted and to have their hats cleaned and reblocked. The company also maintained a reputation for being an excellent place to work. Founder John B. Stetson had established a tradition of care and concern for his workers that carried on long after his death in 1906. And it is Stetson's industrial paternalism, in many ways a model of the way things were supposed to work between an employer and his employees back in the early 20th century, that is the principal subject of today's program. A few years ago, I had a tour of what remained of the Stetson Hat Factory with Bill Johnson, its caretaker.
There wasn't a broken window. There wasn't an empty house, there wasn't a vacant lot, because, for one reason only, the people who worked here had a responsibility to the place because they only lived a few blocks away and they walked to work.
Yeah.
So they seen to it that the children of the neighborhood didn't ever even break a Stetson window because I worked for Stetson, you understand? That was the logic, but that's gone. It's quite a story. There wasn't a better man. I myself can speak very highly of it because it's been a great place. This company was so great that John B. Stetson wanted to start a bank, and the government wouldn't allow that to take place. Industry couldn't own banks, so the next thing he did was start a savings and loan, which was John B. Stetson Savings and Loan. And everybody that worked for the company was allowed to join it and buy their homes through Stetson.
Huh.
And there were hundreds and hundreds of people here in this immediate vicinity of, say, 10 blocks around us, was able to buy their home through the same place they earned their living by. So naturally, once you're on a steady payroll, you never got lost, laid off because you're paying for your house out of your paycheck.
So it worked both ways.
This was the original auditorium. This place has quite a score. This is where the immigrants came right off the boat, got their naturalization, got their schooling all right here. There was an organ there. This was a Sunday school. He didn't even let the people get away from him after Friday. The employees came here on Saturday and Sunday, and on Sunday they had Sunday school for the children. They had it all. See that sign over there?
Yeah.
Mission Hospital, 1887 to 1904. That hospital didn't start there. That hospital started here.
Huh.
For one reason. John B. Stetson loved his people. And when he would miss someone from work, he would ask, where is John so-and-so or Joe so-and-so? Oh, he's sick. Okay. My doctor will be in Monday to see me. Have Joe so-and-so here Monday morning in my office, and I'll have my doctor look at him. And this is how John B. Stetson Hospital begun. It started with him having his employees in his own personal office to be looked at. It got so big that he started a dispensary here. And from there, it got so big that he says, it looks like I got to put up a hospital now. And there it is. And the whole story is in there. It was a wonderful thing. And that, to me, in my mind, is gone completely from the country, from industry, from everything. That feeling, that closeness of an employee and an employer is completely gone. Where the employer says, okay, I'm making a dollar, I'm giving 50 cents back to my people. And that is forever gone. And this is one of the few in the city of Philadelphia that was that way.
What Bill was describing were some of a variety of services for the employees and their families, which made them part of what was known as the Stetson family. These services grew out of the religious beliefs of old John B. Stetson, and also out of the realization that workers with a stake in the company and surrounding community would be productive and reliable, an important consideration in an industry then still plagued with itinerancy and irregular work habits. By the early 20th century, many of the Stetson rank and file, like Bill, came from the surrounding neighborhood, grew up participating in the Stetson-sponsored programs. The company would hire neighborhood kids in their early teens and place them in some of the apprenticeships in the front shops, learning the different steps in the manufacture of a quality hat. Herb also grew up in the neighborhood and got his first job at Stetson in 1917. How did you get your first job at Stetson?
Well, I just went to the employment office and asked about a job, because Stetson's was one of the places in the neighborhood that took in so many neighborhood people.
So it was pretty easy to get a job there?
Not really easy, because so many neighborhood people went there. If you went at the right time when they needed somebody, fine, you got in right away. But very often they were filled up. Didn't need any people because there was so many people in the neighborhood. They all wanted to get into Stetson's.
Why was that?
Because of their good reputation for treating the employees. See, the bonus and the Christmas turkeys and candy and gloves and hats that they gave out at Christmas time, that was a big incentive.
What sort of people worked at Stetson?
What sort of people? Well, working class people. As far as nationality goes, there was an awful lot of Italians, but they were mostly in the back shop, what they call the forming, sizing, and fur cutting departments. In the finishing and what we call the front shop, all the final stages, they were pretty well mixed people. The Italians in the back shop, they were on, you might even say, a basis where they came from Italy. They were almost assured of a job by their relatives that worked in Stetson's.
Huh. How did that work?
Well, like if you had a brother in Europe and you're working in Stetson's, and you write over and say, hey, I got a good job in Stetson's, come on over, I'll get you a job. This could be done, and this is the way it was done. The family relationships, you know.
Angelo Catalino came over from Sicily, and through his brother-in-law, got a job in Stetson's sizing department in 1906. His son Tony, also a hat maker like his father, also remembers the company fondly.
Went to Stetson because Stetson was in a ball. They had all the facilities, they had all the, it was so clean, so it was really, it wasn't a sweatshop, you know what I mean? It was really in, they were a good company to work for. You couldn't find a better. And you know, I heard from Dad many a times that John B. Stetson, he was a really human being. You know what I mean? He treated his workers, you know. And you might, if you go around that section of the city, all three-story homes, they're all demolished today there. You know, they're beautiful. He made homes for them. I heard the story that there was Staten Hospital. He took care of all of the employees and people that got bonuses. At the end of the year, they got turkeys. And I know I was a little boy. My daddy used to take me there. We used to see Punt and Judy show, you know, and they used to give us pretzels, they used to give us ice cream. You know, when I was a kid, it ain't like today, you know, when we got a cup of ice cream but you know, it was something those days, you know, and we enjoyed it very much, and he did everything, you know, that he was really a human being. He took care of his employees. Not only that, my daddy, when he came from Europe, they had a school, and my daddy learned how to get his citizen paper from John B. Stetson. And he went there. At night, he learned, and he got a senior citizen from John B. Stetson. How do you like that?
Huh.
Yeah, that's right.
So he went to the Americanization classes,
that's
I guess.
That's right there. They had everything. Like I said, I mean, he was a God-given man. You know what I mean?
The Americanization classes that Tony's father attended, another part of the Stetson system, were not uncommon in many industries after the First World War. Though benevolent motives played some part in their development, they resulted largely from widespread fears that the waves of new immigrants flooding America's shores brought with them foreign sympathies and radical, subversive ideas. These classes were discontinued in the mid-1920s after the flow of immigrants was curtailed by federal legislation. There's a great deal more that can be said about the many immigrants employed at Stetson's. As Herb said, they were for the most part confined to the back shops where the most unpleasant and hazardous work was done. But for now, let's get back to our tour.
There's a lot of pigeon dirt, so when you go down, wash your hands, got it?
Okay.
You gotta see this.
This is the clock tower we're going up to?
We're up in it.
Far out.
But we were safe, though. Because when that one breaks downtown, at Independence Hall,
yeah,
we got the replacement for it right here.
Well, how old is this?
There it is, right there, 1889.
Good Lord.
Hey, put your hand on that.
That bell must be 4 or 5 feet in diameter.
And it's about five inches thick, too.
Every bit as good as the one they got downtown. We don't even have a crack in ours. And this is a hammer that struck the hour, the quarter hour. This is the way it's done. And boy, it had a beautiful sound to it. Now, up top is the mechanism that we wound once a week. They bundle it with weights. This is what the Vandals did to us. They busted it up on us. Now, can you see any logic to people destroying things like this?
No. Boy, this is an incredible room. There are four clock faces in there. They provide all the light.
Out of Boston put this in here in 1889. And we see, even there's this is the crank. Guy would sit here for about an hour and a half taking turns winding it up. So, and it'd be all set. Oil it up. It didn't look nothing like this fella. There wasn't a piece of dirt on the floor. This place was immaculate. I maintained that clock.
Uh-huh.
My men wound it up. It's a wind-up clock, an 8-day clock. And two of my mechanics every Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock, we'd go up and wind up for an hour and a half, and then set it up for the following week.
How accurate was it?
It was right on the button. In fact, the whole neighborhood went to sleep and woke up by the chimes of that bell.
Huh.
Including me. When we tore down the main auditorium, which was erected in 1906,
yeah,
that held nearly 5,000 people seated.
This
well,
is
we'll a, show it all yeah, to you when you get back to the... We'll yeah. give you a good rundown on it so you can mm-hmm. frame it all out. That auditorium was beautiful. In the early days, it was a place for lunch hour. They would put in a five-piece band, and the employees would have time to dance a half an hour while they ate their lunch and things like that. And at Christmas time, we all congregated there and was paid off for our good work. And over and above work with turkeys, full baskets, stock, bonuses. That feeling, fella, is gone.
The Christmas party, which stands out in the memories of all Stetson employees I've talked to, was symbolically at the heart of the Stetson system. Begun by Stetson himself, it became an annual extravaganza at which employees and their families would gather for a program of speakers, prayer, musical performances, and the gifts and bonuses. In 1920, for example, each worker received a bonus of 10% as annual wages. As was the custom every year, married men got their turkeys, single men their hats, the women their candy and gloves. And in addition, there were presented 425 shares in the Stetson Savings and Loan Association, 75 shares of common stock, and 5 life insurance policies of $5,000 each. The whole package totaling some $525,000, no mean sum in those days. It all seems to form, at least at first glance, quite a remarkable picture of corporate benevolence. But every story is subject to different interpretations, and many workers, including Herb, had mixed reactions to the Christmas largesse.
A lot of people always looked forward to Christmas and the bonus because they were so far in debt they needed help. And this was the answer to a lot of problems. So everybody looked forward to it. As for their sincere interest, I wouldn't know how to say that. Dyed-in-the-wool Stetson employees, they would say yes, they really appreciate it, and had great admiration for the things that were done by Stetson. But then on the other hand, you got people that say, I earned it regardless of what anybody else says. So with a person that says that, you can't say that they are sincerely behind the whole thing. So I was about this way. Sometimes,
somewhere in between.
Somewhere in between. I had my likes and dislikes. I wouldn't say that Stetson was the greatest place in the world to work. I wouldn't say it was the worst either.
The American Federation of Labor had no doubts about the meaning of the Christmas awards and the Stetson family system. In 1916, an organizer wrote,
"The John B. Stetson Company organized what it declared to be, quote, a model factory and made it one of the show places of Philadelphia. It declared it had solved the labor problem. This solution consisted of substituting for fair wages, Christmas gifts, annual premiums, bronze medals for efficiency, and valuable service to the firm. Every device and regulation was instituted to generate the spirit of feudalism and to drive out the spirit of independence and liberty that are inseparable from organized labor."
So was it corporate benevolence, presents from a generous and caring father, or withheld wages presented in the specious form of Christmas gifts meant to bind the workers to the company, a means to keep the rank and file subservient and prevent them from insisting upon their right to administer their own wages as they saw fit. Undoubtedly, it was a bit of both and more. As Herb said, he fell somewhere in between those like Bill, who were devoted to the Stetson plan, and the opposite union position. Regardless of where one stood, however, the rank and file did have some very real grievances, some of which grew out of the old paternalistic model of relationships.
Stetson's had a lot of old-fashioned ideas, and they carried them out, like an apprentice furnisher that worked on the 6th, 7th, or 8th floor. They were not allowed to use the elevators to go up and down. They had to walk. The journeyman finishers, they were allowed to use the elevators. Big deal, you know. I'm a finisher. I'm allowed privileges, but the apprentices were not. As for working conditions, the foreman, he was the supreme being, and very often they acted out beyond their real necessity. If a foreman felt like sending a person home at 10 o'clock in the morning, he could send them home for any reason whatsoever. Maybe a stoppage in work or a lack of work coming through, or it would have to wait for a while for work to come through. He could send people home, 1 or 10 or as many as he wanted, to, you know, accommodate his needs. He held up, upheld his end, and he would do that at any cost. Of course, the worker had to suffer for it. In the beginning, when so much was handled by the boss, you had very little to say. You could not put up any kind of an argument about anything because he was the supreme. He could you go home for a couple of days, don't come back, or don't come back for a week, or things of that sort. Coming in late, if you were to ring the clock late, even at 1 minute, if the boss wanted to send you home, he would, or he could rather, and many did. And I know of a guy, he was an apprentice, he was not allowed to ride the elevator, he had to walk up 8 flights of stairs, and he was just coming in the department door as the whistle blew. See, they used to go by a whistle. The whistle was not yet done when he was in the room, but he was not in his spot. So he was sent home for a week.
Other problems also existed. Work for the unskilled immigrants in the back shops was grueling, and while other hat companies in the city were eager to employ Stetson workers, the worker turnover for the company was quite high. The story of Tony's father is a good example of this movement, part of the fabled process of American upward mobility.
Why did he leave?
Well, because he wanted to get out of that sweatshop, you know what I mean? See, and then he got talking to some fella that worked in Stetson, that went to Style Park. And that's how they got together, you know. So you come over there, you don't have to be in that sweatshop anymore. You learn to be a hat finisher. It's different. You see, a hat finisher, the body of a hat is already made up. When the finisher is, when you get it, it's a raw body. You get it, you put it on the block, you shape it, you give it color and so forth and so on. It ain't none of that hot water. And then I see my daddy's hand before they got the machine. It used to be red, it used to be brown, it used to be black. You know me, rubbing them hats. Some of the dye used to come off. And boy, did he have the calluses.
So by now we're beginning to see a series of conditions. Archaic rules, grueling work, and the excessive powers of the floor bosses, who were in truth quite restrained when compared to their counterparts in other companies who were known to require kickbacks and sexual favors from some of their workers. In addition, Stetson workers were subject to a situation characteristic of many of Philadelphia's industries, and that was seasonal work. Underemployment was a chronic problem for industrial workers in the city, and even at Stetson, with its outstanding reputation, seasonal unemployment was the rule. There were generally two slack seasons, in the fall, after the Christmas rush, and in the spring, after the summer fashions had come out. Together, they meant that a Stetson employee might be out of work for as many as 4 months in the year. Now, in the days of large families and $4-a-week salaries, that was Angelo Catalano's starting wage at Stetson, these layoffs could be devastating, and second jobs were a necessity. When the economy was strong, there were many different jobs that Stetson workers could do during the slack seasons. Herb remembers that older employees often ran their own hat repair shops, or took temporary work, like Tony's father and other hat shops in the city. Herb himself learned to be a sign painter. But when the economy was enduring one of its frequent periodic downswings, when jobs were scarce and money tight, that indispensable second income could be hard to come by. Even if the father was making enough to support a family while employed, and this was by no means the rule, his periods of seasonal unemployment necessitated other sources of income for the family, which is one of the reasons why so many children quit school at the age of 14 and went to work in the city's many mills and factories. When the Depression struck this whole economic system of low wages and family economies, and the Stetson plan as well, were subjected to insuperable strains. The Christmas parties ended in 1930, and the arbitrariness of the floor bosses became increasingly hard to bear. To keep the factory running, many of the iniquities of the paternal system were pushed to the breaking point.
Nobody had any rights or privileges to bargain or talk about their job. Foreman, he was it. What he said, that's what you had to do. And they would bring you in, and if you only worked a half hour, they could send you home. You didn't make enough to pay your car fare, right? this was very objectionable, and this was almost a common practice, where Foreman would say, come in tomorrow. He might tell you, come in, we only got 4 hours work. Well, this would be fine. But then you're working an hour and he finds out that there isn't going to be 4 hours work. He'll send you home in an hour, half an hour. Some other times you would be off. You wouldn't exactly be off, but you would have maybe 2 or 3 days a week work. Now, I can remember, this stands out in my mind vividly. One payday, I was living in Westville, Jersey, and I came all the ways up. I wasn't working that day, but it was payday. And I come all the ways up from Jersey to get a pay, 67 cents, because I had only worked a half hour that week. Yeah, many a time I come home with $2, $3, $4 for a pay, $6 for a pay. It used to be, let's see, I don't know when it started, but way back, if you worked there for 25 years, you got a week's vacation.
But not until then.
Not until 25 years. That was your vacation. You got a week then. Well, after the union got in, everybody, I don't know what the limitations were, 6 months or a year or something like that. Then you got a week vacation. This began in around 45. Well, then later on we got another week. Wound up with 2 weeks vacation.
A week's vacation after 25 years service. Can you imagine? Then at least they were working only 5 days a week. Remember, it wasn't so long ago that the nation's steel workers were putting in 12-hour days, 7-day weeks, with no benefits or vacations. But the Depression and the Second World War wrought mighty changes in the city's workplaces, and the days of industrial paternalism, for better or for worse, were for the most part over. After unsuccessful efforts at organizing an internal union, the Stetson rank and file joined the United Hatters, Cap, and Millinery Workers International Union in 1936. Stetson weathered the depression and adjusted without major incidents to the presence of an outside union. But it was to prove incapable to maintain its high standards of quality production in the post-war economy, a challenge made even harder by a major change in men's fashions, for men gradually but steadily stopped wearing hats.
It was a progressive thing, and the more it grew, the less business we had. That's how Stetson's went from 6,000 employees down to 450.
6,000 down to 450. Mm-hmm. In how many years?
Well, I guess it was over a period of 35 years.
You know, that Philadelphia, I could walk in one hat shop into another years ago here. You see, they had ladies' hat shop, and they're all gone. There ain't a hat shop but one hat shop in the city. It's ladies' hats. It's on Filbert Street between 11th and 12th, I think. My brother works there.
Neither manufacturer.
Not the manufacturer. Ladies' hats. No more hats.
Stetson's was always a quality product, top of the line. As men stopped wearing hats, as the union obtained better wages and benefits for its members, as the company mechanized to cut costs and speed production, the classic Stetson hat became increasingly difficult to produce and market at affordable costs. Even after later attempts at diversification, Stetson couldn't make the transition to the new economic rules of post-war America. The huge plant itself was physically outmoded and increasingly expensive to run. Workers, freed by the automobile and better salaries, fled the neighborhood. Stetson finally closed its doors in 1973. When I toured the factory in 1980, only three buildings remained of the once massive Stetson complex.
I saved this to last. This is World War II. This isn't the whole city of Philadelphia on here. This is just the employees that went off to this war. I'm one there myself, which I'm proud of. I survived Germany, and I'm back here. William Johnson. These are all people I knew, personally, knew them, including this one.
John B. Stetson III.
That John B. III, he was shot down.
Was
he? He was a pilot in World War II. And
he was grandson of the
founder. Right. Now, there was another Stetson that was under another name, which Jules has his name. He died too. Two Stetsons went down in this thing.
I noticed there are a lot of the same names. For example, Pinos,
a
lot of families.
Right on the head. Yeah. This was a family place. Mm-hmm. You came here, your father brought you. Your uncle worked here. Your grandson worked here. Your father worked here. Your aunt worked here. And that's the way it was.
You got Goldstein, Sweeney, Sullivan.
You got all kinds
of...
That's what we were thinking. But I got brothers of mine. Both of my brothers were in the hat business. And my sister was in the hat business, too. We were all in the hats. You know, in them days, it was the Catalano family, the Contito family, the DeLuca family. They were all in groups. You understand, when we used to work. Even outside of Stetson, see?
How do you mean in groups?
Well, a family affair, you know? The closeness and style park.
On the night of September 4th, 1980, the remaining buildings of the Stetson complex burned down in a fire apparently set by vandals. As a final ironical note to the story, the city received a ransom note for the clapper of the Stetson bell. So how well did the Stetson system actually work? Herb, who worked there some 49 years and 7 months, has his own opinions.
With Stetson's, you, during your dull period, you accumulated a lot of debts. So then you say, well, when I get working, I'll pay you back. So you start working, you get paid back, and hey, well, next week, another payment, and I'm pretty well on the line again. But that week is the week, hey, you're off for next 2 weeks. You know, you're right back where you started from. You never got ahead. So, all in all, I would say I wouldn't want to do it again.
In many ways, you can see in Stetson's story the history of the city in microcosm. It drew immigrants and gave them their start in ethnically divided work tasks. Work was generally skilled, labor-intensive, and seasonal. Stetson's benevolent variety of paternalism, once so progressive, by the time of the Depression was sorely out of step with the times. And in the end, Stetson's, like so many of Philadelphia's other industries that grew up in the 19th century, such as the lace trade, hosiery, and rugs to name but a few, was unable to adjust to the post-war world and the ineluctable change in fashions. And in the end, like so many other businesses, it outlived its neighborhood, closed, and finally burned down, leaving space for the next stage in the city's growth.
I Remember When, Time's Gone But Not Forgotten is written and produced by Charles Hardy. Funding for this program has been made possible by grants from the Pennsylvania Humanities Council, the Colonial Pen Group, the Margaret Durant Strawbridge Foundation, and the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation. Today's contributors include Tony Catalana, Roman Zabriskie, William Johnson, Ed Curlin, and John Rudolph. The engineer was Rob Richards. Your host, Charles Hardy.
Well, them days it was cool, and anybody worked in a hat. Whoa, you're working a step. Oh, my, you got a good job. You're making money. See, that was a good reputation. Of course, they knew the guy made a, at least they made a living, you know? See, like that. Well, see, them days they didn't pay much. They knew it was a good factory. They knew that they were treated good. They knew they used to get a bonus. They knew they used to get a candy or a turkey, they used to get. They used to get a turkey. You know, them days, oh, boy. You know, and I remember my dad, when we used to get that turkey, a little bit went to my aunt, a little bit went to our next-door neighbor. We were lucky we had it, you know? You see, that's the way it was. Share and share alike, you know what I mean? Every family, you know, not like today. Them days, they worked more closeness.